From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at KCRW.com. My guest, director Vadim Perelman, has a way of taking the psychological states of his character and making them play, in effect, as plot points. He did it in his first film, the adaptation of House of Sand and Fog, and his newest film, an adaptation of the book Light Before Our Eyes. Vadim, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
First of all, if you can let the audience know what the film's about.
Without giving too much away, the film is about the inciting event of the film is a high school shooting, and two best friends, two girls, one played by Evan Rachel Wood, the other one played by Eva Amuri, are in a bathroom. Suddenly, they hear shots outside. A gunman bursts in, points the gun at them,
and a fellow student, we should say, a fellow high school student, bursts in.
Exactly, their classmate bursts in, and Eva Murray's character, Maureen, says, "Shoot me," and he points the gun at her friend and says, "What do you think?" And she gives an answer, which I think informs the process of the thought of that, of her thought at that time, informs the movie. It really does.
Now, one of the things you've done in the two films that you've made is very much about a kind of a disharmony between the spirit and the body and the kind of repercussions, dramatic repercussions that are left when the body and the spirit and body and the soul, in fact, are in disharmony.
Yeah, it's about emotional states. It definitely is. And in the first film, it was really a Greek tragedy in a way, with everybody. You know, everybody had a fatal flaw or many flaws, and everybody had some good in them. So there was really no, and that was one of the good things about it, and I think what I strove to achieve there is to achieve a balance in sympathy for both characters. You know, even though they both did reprehensible things and good things at the same time.
And we're talking about in that previous movie Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley, but also I'm so struck in your films just about how these characters, when they fall out of touch with themselves physically, how much free fall there is psychologically for them.
No, it's an interesting observation. Yeah, and the same happens with Uma's character.
Absolutely.
Which I'll finish telling the story. We flash forward from that shooting 15 years into the future, and now Evan Rachel Wood is Uma Thurman as actors. And she lives a kind of idyllic lifestyle, seemingly idyllic lifestyle, in a Connecticut suburb with a husband, professor husband, beautiful daughter, beautiful house. Everything's blooming all around her. And then her life starts deteriorating. Her life starts kind of falling apart, wearing thin at the edges. And the reveal is that this is exactly why it's due to. And meanwhile, we're flashing back to the two young girls' relationship and how it affects Uma's future as well.
I'm just wondering for you where this grounding for some characters in spirituality comes from, because it's key in both films, or at least a pursuit of that.
Both my films are based on books. So I of course can't claim credit for it, but I definitely responded to that.
So few films, certainly films made in this continent, deal with that as kind of a pursuit of drama, you know, looking for truth, characters looking for their own truths, and how those conflicting truths create drama.
That's exactly it. That is the root of drama, is conflicting truths.
And just you talking about certainly Greek tragedy for House of Sand and Fog, but there's a parable aspect to Light Before Our Eyes. It's about that same kind of thing too, about sort of at the very least trying to clear the fog, if you will, and figure out what the truth is for Diana. And that must be really kind of rich material to use as a director, because what it allows you to do is to sort of dispense with the mechanics of the plot and deal with these really as character pieces, doesn't it?
It's true. But one of the problems with this film in executing it lied that if I could just settle on what you're talking about and just attack that the way I did in House, Sand and Fog, this one had an intellectual component. This one, I had to create clues. It had a whole other layer that really supported the twist at the end. And that is something that I think made it more difficult and perhaps even more confusing to some viewers. Than House of Fog is very straightforward. It's just an emotional roller coaster ride. You know, this one is an emotional film, but there's a whole other layer. It's like, it's basically like watching two screens at once in a strange way. Like your brain is split.
It really is a sort of question between the id and superego too, in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of split you're talking about even exists in House in Sand and Fog as well. I mean, someone who's really kind of aware of himself being Ben Kingsley's character and this pursuit of right as compared to this person who's in free fall and is sort of dealing with everything emotionally rather than intellectually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. And yeah, I mean, this is a man driven by pride, you know, absolutely in every way, in every shape, way, and form. He's way too proud, you know, and she's not proud enough.
Not proud at all.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the treatment, my guess, as director Vadim Perelman. His new film is Life Before Her Eyes. But one of the things that fascinates me about both the films, too, is that vanity plays such a part for characters, you know? I mean, certainly the young version of Diana, I mean, there's that kind of vanity that has to be stripped away. So as we see the film play out, it's coming to an understanding. And I wonder how much this is influenced by just movies you've seen versus stuff you've read, because there's a literary aspect outside of the books to both of the films that you've directed.
It's mostly influenced by the books that I've read. I think because I purposely avoid watching films before I make a movie, I'm really not a cinephile. You know, I read a lot. I read a lot of books, and I was really blessed since I was young to be able to see the book. And not just see it in a visual sense as well, and see the structure of a shorter form of it. When I was a kid, I was in camp because I have a heart condition. I was stuck with these kids that were literally blue kids my age that had to be walking with a walker and being supported and all that. And I just have a small heart condition that I've compensated for, and there's no problem in my life. So what I would do, I just felt like such a kinship with these kids. At the time that I would lie on a bunk I would read a book. And I would lie on a bunk at late at night as we were supposed to sleep, and tell them stories from that book. And invariably, what they were is they were condensed visual versions of the book. And that's so I unknowingly, completely, and without having any kind of film, you know, I was kind of telling them films at that time.
We should say, by the way, that you grew up in Russia until you were a teenager, right? And then you came to Canada. Because also there are opposing worlds that exist very much in the two films you made so far, too. And I wonder how much of that, too, comes from your growing up in one world, formative experiences in Russia, and then coming to North America, where there's a kind of an ostensible freedom, but also a lack of responsibility in pursuit of that freedom. And that's – these two movies are very much about responsibility.
Exactly what it is about. It's about responsibility, and it's also about alienation, I think, in a way. The first film was about an immigrant experience, how you can come to a country and as soon as you immigrate to another country, you lose your identity. You completely lose your former identity. People can't even pronounce your born name properly anymore. And in this film, it's about alienation of these two girls. I mean, they're raised by single mothers who are largely absent from their lives. I mean, there's actually a lot made of that. And husbands, you know, fathers are gone somewhere, who knows where. And the male figures in this life is a professor who may or may not exist and a shooter, really. And a guy who knocks up one of the girls and she has to get an abortion. So it's a woman's movie.
It really is that. It's, by the way, it is a treatment, I guess, as director Vadim Perelman. We were talking to him on the occasion of his second film, A Light Before Her Eyes. But you have a talent for drawing us into the psychological state of the characters, dealing with the characters rather than just laying out the plot, because anybody can say, this happens, this happens, this happens, this happens.
And it's
gotta
not
be about feeling.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. It's about feeling. It's about this happened and then he felt that way. Or he felt that way and therefore he did that. You know, that's much more interesting to me, way of telling the story. For me, it's very important to move people. That's really the only thing that I want as the outcome. Make them think to a certain extent, but really mostly move people. And I was so raised on Russian way of moving people, which is perhaps a little bit more over the top than the American way of moving.
It's really melodramatic, yeah.
Much more melodramatic. And I've always thought that that should not be used in a negative sense, melodramatic. A lot of people use it in a negative sense, but it just means, doesn't it mean more dramatic? It really does. So I don't think that that's really a bad thing. Yeah.
But there's a real power in that you're completely, I think, respectful of. And I think it's a unique point of view. It feels more like an old world kind of storytelling to me rather than something of the modern world.
Yes. I'm perhaps too earnest. And I don't have any cynicism. You know, I read a little while ago that this beautiful quote that said, no, I can't remember who it was from, can't attribute it, but it was, no cynic can ever be a poet. And I think that's, you know, that's pretty much where I live.
There's no obfuscating that heart for you. I mean, that beating heart is key to what you do as a dramatist.
Yeah, but
it?
Also it's key to every person on this earth. I think everybody has a beating heart. I think everybody has a soul. I think everybody has, you know, everybody cries when a dear one dies. Everybody is overjoyed when a child is born. You know, it's there are just ways of barriers, as Balzac said, there's barriers between that event and that perception of that event and how you react to it. And I think a lot of my films, you know, kind of divide people into two camps, you know, people who let that into their heart and people who don't.
But death and the threat of death is prevalent very much so in these
very
films
much so,
you made.
Very much so. It's about death. Well, this one is definitely about death, much more so than the last one. Actually has actual death in it. This one has a dreaded death, a fear of death.
Maybe we should say then is that dread, because that becomes a way for you, the characters measure themselves against this dread or this threat and how they will stand up to it. You know, that's a real measure of who they become as people, isn't it?
That's what this film is. It's a film about choices that you make, you know, and it's largely The Life Before Our Eyes is a film about the choices you make and how they inform and construct your future and how we create futures, our perceived or real futures, how we create them from events in our past, events in our present. They become just building blocks. The cues in that become building blocks. For example, if we see a yellow dog on the street today just walking by, next time we think of a dog, an abstract dog in our future, like maybe I will have a dog at some point, we will see a yellow dog. It's kind of, and that's what this film, a lot of devices that it uses.
Sure.
It's that kind of echoing.
Yeah, the echoing and that kind of circular aspect that's very much a part of Parable. I mean, which is, again, a literary device rather than a filmic device, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Somebody who is well-versed in literary form. I'm an absorber of art, of literature, and perhaps a prism through which sometimes it shines through, through my films. But I'm not I don't know these devices you talk about. I don't know them in a technical sense.
But
I use them.
You certainly use them. Yeah.
Inadvertently.
Well, we'll take a break. We'll see if we can make Vadim Perlman a little bit less complex in this break.
Please.
We're talking about his second film, Life Before Our Eyes. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a treatment which you can also hear at kcrw.com.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is the less complicated than he seems, Vadim Perelman. He's directed the films House of Sand and Fog and his newest, Life Before Her Eyes. But what I'm saying is that this is not something we tend to see filmmakers do. I mean, so many times filmmakers come here, and even though they certainly have done adaptations and are aware of literary conventions, they use film and film conventions as a way to tell stories. And you use people as a way to tell the stories. I mean, you've made it much more about the characters. For you, it's about what these characters are feeling. And then when these events happen, we have another understanding of how these people lead their lives because they're reacting emotionally.
And it's actually quite often, and especially in the case of this film, it's quite often we see the way the character is reacting. We infer what they're feeling. And then we understand why. Which is sometimes, you know, that it's kind of a backwards way of doing it. It's like, do you show POV first and then show a person's reaction? Or do you show a person's reaction and then show a POV? And it's more, I think it's more European way to show the person's reaction than show the POV.
But what that does, though, is it ends up creating suspense. I mean, it's interesting because these films both have a kind of thriller aspect to them because of that sense of dread that gets developed.
What's interesting is that both films, as uncomfortable as they may be, not a single person ever moves in an audience. And people have noticed that. You know, studio people come to me and they tell me that. And even the focus group people, they say, we've never seen that. We've never seen, like, people just sit there like a mausoleum. It's like Easter Island over there in the audience. I think it's because... Well, part of it is because even though they're very slow-paced, both films, and you can imagine a lot of fidgeting going on in films like that, but for some reason not there. And I think it is because I keep a suspense, even if it's not a plot suspense, it's a suspense of why people are feeling that way.
And what are they going to do next?
And then what are they going to do next? And if you notice, actually, in House of Sand and Fog, I didn't use any of these tropes here. In House of Sand and Fog, we get closer and closer and closer to the characters through the film. I literally mapped it out. Just our focal lengths. We get more and more telephoto as the film goes on. You know, which is, and you know, ultimately the ultimate bag scene with Bronny puts the bag on his head. That's like we're in his eyes at that point.
And there even tends to be, in the beginning of both films, a kind of a stillness. The characters are moving in the frame rather than a zoom or something like that.
I'll give another film device that I use all the time that I actually learned from Roger Deakins.
He was a
cinematographer for the first film, yeah. That is doing a moving shot. Say you're going into a room with a character. Starting out with the moving shot going into as a POV, and she would walk into her own POV. You know, to me, it's a great shot to show subjective, and to meld the subjective and the objective together. Point of view. And it's a really neat device that I use. If you can watch for it, I use all the time. You know, whenever there's a character entering frame, they always enter from a POV. It's kind of cool.
Well, now we have something to watch for. The Treatment, I guess, is the director of Idine Perlman. His second film, which we're talking about, is Life Before Her Eyes. I'm wondering, too, about the casting, because you choose people with really intense eyes for the films. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the gaze is really important in these actors. I mean, be it the actors in House of Sand and Fog or the actresses
in this one.
I mean, that gaze is really key. I mean, in some shots of Evan Rachel Wood, she's not blinking.
And some shots she's fluttering too. When she hears the noises in the bathroom, there's a great, like, amazing performance that she does there.
Because that becomes a subjective thing for us, too. I mean, we sort of feel like we're in the place of the characters based on that gaze of theirs.
Again, I would love to say that I consciously do it. No, I just get...
But do you see what I'm talking about?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do. And you see so much reflected in those eyes, too, not just coming through them.
But water is very important in both these films, too. I mean, as kind of freedom. Or representation of freedom.
I think nature in general.
Sure.
It's you know, the first film, again, the fog footage and the time-lapse footage, it was my way. I actually shot that before even filming the movie.
Really?
Yeah. I sent my commercial DP out with a map because I'd scouted it all by myself. I just drove around and took photos with a time-lapse camera, you know, intervalometer and just beautiful stuff. And I just sit there until there's fog. And he had a little motorhome. Little camera assistant and a bunch of beer, and he was the happiest man in the world. He was, got to get away from his girlfriend. It was exactly what he wanted to do. And he was out there for 2 weeks, and he came back with a stunning footage of the bridge. You know, a lot of that was done by him.
Wow.
Yeah, the Golden Gate Bridge and the San Francisco beauty, waves, things like that. And on this one, I did a similar thing, except it happened during the filming. I had my commercials DP, different guy. filming all this macro stuff, bees, worms, ants, buds, flowers, a lot of flowers, rain. That was in the book, actually. That's not something I came up with. I might have come up with some, you know, one or two of those things. But generally, the book was that evocative and the book was that lyrical.
Well, part of this, too, I mean, you talked about telling stories to your schoolmates. But there's a kind of compression that you learn from doing music videos and commercials. I mean, they tend to be not so much about the visual surfaces rather than creating an emotional state, the things you've done. Just trying to get an emotional state across quickly. I'm not saying there's that kind of distress.
There's not that kind of depth to them, I don't think.
They're not damaged people in these commercials.
Yeah, there's no depth that much. The music video I did actually is quite tragic.
Yeah, oh, my God. Yes, I mean, it is tragic.
It actually made people cry.
Tell people about that, Kelly Clarkson.
Kelly called me and out of the blue, really. And she said, I'm a big fan of the film and House in a Fog. And she said, would you mind doing a video? And I said, listen, I'm not into your kind of music, like, at all. You know, I'm like, you know, I listen to, like, Aphex Twin and things like that. So, and she said, no, but you know what? You could really bring it to it. And this is something, it's a song I wrote when I was 16. And it's about my parents' divorce, and it's about everybody's parents' divorce. And I think, and at that time, I was going through a divorce, too. So she kind of hit on that button for me. And how we don't want to pass that on to our children, and, you know, that sort of thing. So I sat down and with her came up with a concept for this video, which had to do with multiple reflections of her and so on. But anyway, but it does have a very you know, effect on the audience, adults and you know, her fan base alike.
It's a given what that song is, if I may say, it's a really adult piece of storytelling.
There's actually a little trivia thing that there's a scene in the video that I stole right out of House, Sand, and Fog, an unfilmed scene from House, Sand, and Fog.
Really?
Yeah. It's when the cop was leaving his family. There's a scene when his little daughter runs out after him carrying the suitcases for him, thinking that she's coming with him on a trip, and she brings her own little suitcase. It's so melodramatic. It's crazy. She brings her own little suitcase, and they walk out to the car. And then he just kind of tears the suitcase out of her hand, gets into his car, and she just stands there in the middle of the road as her father's leaving forever. So I said, that's perfect for the video.
The heartbreaker we're talking to is Vadim Perelman. His new film as director is The Light Before Eyes. This is a treatment, which you can also hear at KCRW.com. One of the things that's important in both these movies, too, though, is family and this understanding of kind of a tradition, family traditions being passed along. Or not being passed along, or a kind of emotional heritage being passed along. I mean, we certainly see it here when Diana is dealing with her daughter, who is her, and for Briani in House of Sand and Fog, his son is his light.
It's his reflection.
And that's really important in both.
Very
of these
important
films.
In both these films. Generational stuff is very important.
But also these parents wanting better for their children than they've had.
Even Diana's Evans and Rachel Wood's character in this film even says, "Yeah, I don't want to grow up one of these women who are angry about everything all the time." And they also say with a husband that didn't leave, and all those things are really, they're again, it's people are informed by their past, people's actions in the present and the future are informed by their past and present. You know, I really believe that, and that goes with, you know, passing things on to our children. We are, you know, our kids are reflections of us.
It took you a while before you decided to make a feature and before you – why did it take you – because I'm sure you were getting tons of things offered to you.
I was. But they were not very good movies. You know, they were very much either comedies or bad horror movies. You know,
or things asking for a certain kind of visual panache.
Or commercial director kind of films. And I, you know, I didn't want to do that. I said, why? I'm already making commercials. Why would I make less money, really, at first in features? And end up doing the same kind of thing on a longer, with even almost less freedom. Because, you know, on commercial level that I kind of reached, I kind of had the trust of the agencies. They didn't quite sit behind me. I see these commercial directors come out and do a first movie, like it's some sort of highbrow, lowbrow comedy or whatever it is. They're lucky they get their own monitor on the set. I mean, there's literally producers sitting back there and saying, no, I think we should do more takes of this. Or, no, we're done here. You know, that kind of stuff. We're moving on. Now, that happens all the time. They don't have the freedom. And I wanted to make my own movies. I really did.
And clearly just being able to have the kind of freedom that you wanted, you waited for that circumstance to come to you, didn't you?
Yeah. And it happened very fortuitously because I was an immigrant, a refugee really, with my mother at the age of 14. We lived a very, you know, difficult life at that point. And I ended up being in the street of Rome, literally living in the streets of Rome at the time, holding down jobs, supporting my mother so she could learn English. And I'm now a big flash forward. I'm a big commercials director, very successful, doing a lot of work. And I do this big AT&T job. That's essentially a shoot that's all over the world. One of the stops is Rome, and it's my first time back to Rome. And I wander those streets, and I look around, and I see myself at 14 on those streets. And because I closed that circle, I believe, the next day as I was flying out to go somewhere else, in the airport, I found the book House, Sand, and Fog, just on the rack. It was in the English, one English rack, one of those revolving racks, in a bookstore in the airport. And I just grabbed it and I turned it over and read the back. I got on the plane, read it, and just fell in love with it, of course.
I mean, how old were you when you did your first commercial? Wow.
I was 20.
Because you don't have a conventional film school education at all.
I do, but I dropped out.
That's what I mean. Yeah, you didn't.
Yeah, I didn't finish. You know, I went for a year and a half of the 4 years.
Right, but you dropped out because why?
Because I felt like I wanted to do it already. I think it wasn't a case of, oh, I knew everything, but it's just I was itching to get my hands.
Was it too theoretical for you and not enough application?
Yeah, there was a lot of what I felt were extraneous courses too. You know, I called it finger painting. At the time, which was a lot of, you know, some of them were obviously very valuable, like art history and so on, but some of them were like, we actually literally had a course called art, where we had to draw the color wheel, and we had to stay within the lines, too. It was very interesting. I'll never forget this teacher. This teacher in my whole life, she was about a 60-year-old housewife, essentially teaching this course to film students, to radical film students. It was supposed to have rounded you out somehow. I don't know how, but that was part of them.
Well, apparently it didn't, and you felt like you had to go out and do something.
Yeah, that was actually what drove me out. And I said, and then there was another class where we were dismantling, like a rifle, dismantling and putting together cameras from like 1955, the old like war cameras. And I said, this isn't filmmaking. I mean, so anyway, there was many good courses as well, I just felt like I was wasting my time, pretty much.
And did you feel right away, as soon as you were on the shooting floor, that you had an aptitude for it? Or did it take a while for you to feel like you knew what you were doing? Or that you had a feel for it?
I had an elation in making even those little stupid student films. And believe me, they were stupid. A real elation in creating. You know, that was the one thing. So for me, simply by the fact that I created it, I was kind of proud of it at the time. I mean, nobody ever came and said, oh boy, you really have a talent for it at that time at all. Except my mom.
Well, I'm sorry, but we're out of time. Thanks so much for doing this.
It's a pleasure.
My guest is Vadim Perelman. His new film, of course, is A Life Before Her Eyes. Our technical director here at Argo Networks in New York is Paul Ruest. Bob Carlson is the editor. Gemma Dempsey is the producer. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.